Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
Could you whisper in my ear the things you want to feel? I'll give you anything to feel it coming. Do you wake up on your own?
I was remiss in not saying this earlier, but I didn't know he was a Marine, but Jay Johnstone, former Major League Baseball player, had a great career as a pinch hitter and a former Marine. Yeah. Jay Johnstone played in the big leagues from 1966 to 1985. And then went on to, I guess, a career in television. Played with the Angels, the White Sox, the A's, the Phillies, I remember most, and the Dodgers. He's a funny, funny guy. He was a radio commentator for the Yankees for a year, and then the Phillies for a year. Did not survive in either stint. He's from West Covina, California. Wore number 21 as a rule. Signed as a free agent by the Angels in 1963. As a Philly, he went 7-for-9 in the 1976 National League Championship Series against the Cincinnati Reds. However, the Reds beat him and would go on to play the Boston Red Sox in an epic World Series. Or was that 1975? That might have been 75. As a Dodger, he had a pinch-hit two-run home run in Game 4 of the 1981 World Series against the Yankees. The home run rallied the Dodgers from a 6-3 deficit, and they went on to win 8-7. He died at the age of 74 from complications of COVID. Whoa, the show just ended. What happened? Let's see. He enlisted in the Marine Corps. Now, that was pretty common for athletes, guys who thought they had a career as athletes, because you had to, you were going to be subject to the draft. Jay's father, or Jay, his real name, John William Johnstone, Jr., was born on November 20th, 1945, in Manchester, Connecticut. His family moved to California when Jay was 3 years old. His father, Jack Johnstone, was in combat in the South Pacific with the U.S. Army during World War II. During the war, he met an Australian woman named Audrey Webell, and they married. At one time, he was an accountant back east, said Jay, but when we moved, he was with Supreme and Driftwood Dairy. Jack and Audrey had three children. Jay was the first, followed by a brother and then a sister. I'm trying to find the part where he joined the Marine Corps. Stand by. Well, now I have to do find on this page, which doesn't make me happy. I can't even find that. Download history zoom. Where is that find on this page thing? Come on. Find on page. Here you go. After the 1964 season with the San Jose Bees, Jay enlisted in the Marine Corps Reserve. He received basic training at MCRD San Diego and Camp Pendleton and was able to play in the 1965 season, moving to El Paso in the Texas League, hitting .301 in 97 games. So it was pretty common for athletes to join the reserve, and they would go do their summer training 2 weeks out of the year, and then they would, you know, do their weekend drilling and would be unavailable at times. And so that's how they served. And a lot of them, you know, in their desire to stay away from Vietnam, they joined the reserves. And since reserve units, for the most part, were not mobilized, they stayed out of the war. He then finished out his Marine Corps time at Naval Base in Los Alamitos, receiving his discharge in the spring of 1966 without being ever called to service in country in Vietnam. So Jay Johnstone passed away. This interview with Defense One is an interview with the Commandant of the Marine Corps. And so the person doing interviewing is Katie Bo Williams. So here you have it. Here's Katie. I think she goes on for a minute before the Commandant joins her.
Hi, everybody, and thank you so much for joining us today. Welcome. I'm Katie Bo Williams. I'm the Senior National Security Correspondent at Defense One, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to the third event in our month-long State of Defense series, State of the Marines. This series is the third live extension of our annual State of Defense Special Report, which previews the year ahead. We've got an exciting program ahead today. We've got an exclusive keynote interview with Marine Corps Commandant General David Berger, as well as a panel discussion where we will discuss the future of the branch and the challenges and opportunities that lie ahead. Before we get started, I just want to run over a few housekeeping items. To the right of your screen, you're going to find a chat box. This is where you can ask your questions to General Berger, as well as chat and interact with your fellow attendees. We'll be fielding questions towards the end of the interview, but I do encourage you to go on and submit any questions you have along the way, as I might kind of seed them through as we go along, depending on what folks have to ask. The chat is also where you can ask for technical assistance if you need it. This event is being recorded and will be available on demand shortly for you to share with your colleagues. And I'm going to go on and kick things off. I'm so pleased to welcome General Berger here today. Sir, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today and to be here.
Well, I got a lot of coaching from my peers because CQ Brown is on earlier this week and Jim McConville. So we talk as you might expect. So I was pretty excited about today. So I'm ready for this hour. It's going to be fun.
Well, that's good. I'm glad we didn't scare you off. We'll get right into it. You've been very outspoken on the value of diversity in the Marine Corps, but you know the devil is in the details, as we know. So I'd like to ask you to address a couple of specifics. You've publicly noted that women and people of color take themselves out of the running for.
Interesting, right? The very first topic we're talking about now is diversity. I mean, think about that. Not war fighting, not leadership during this difficult time of COVID. But the very first issue is diversity, right? And you wonder, and think of the United States Navy in this context, right? If that's the single most important thing we're doing, that the most important thing we're doing is being diverse, it's not war fighting, it's not ship driving, it's not airplane flying, it's not being effective at what we're supposed to do, it's being diverse. Think about that. That's the very first thing that she talks about with the Commandant of the Marine Corps.
Our Marine Command screening boards at a much higher rate than their white male counterparts. So I'm curious if you can tell us what the Marine Corps is doing to understand why that's happening, and I assume to address it.
As far as the why, I don't think it's all that complicated. We have to ask them when they're making the decision, why they're making that decision. And we never have really pressed them on that before. We do the kind of surveys that probably most organizations do after they leave. But what we have to do now, I think, to get to your point, is when they're going through the thought process and they're starting to think, I think I just need to leave or retire, then we need to find out the why. Because the factors, the decisions may change later on. So we have to ask the question at the right time. What's the driver's why? And then to your second part, what do you do with that once you figure it out? I think intuitively, we know some of the reasons. All of us do. They leave in order to focus on a family. I mean, all of us would intuitively, I think, in and out of government, sense that that's at least one of the surveys is going to come back because I want to start a family. So we have to figure out, as I pointed out a year ago, internally to ourselves, we have to ask ourselves a question if they're making a decision, because I can't see a path where I can be in the military and be successful and have a family. If I can't do both, okay, then we have to stop right there and figure out what measures we have to take to make both paths viable. And that means things like longer maternity leave, means things like career intermission programs that are more viable, that don't punish them. They don't fall behind their peers. We have a lot of room to work there. On the broader diversity beyond women in those that identify as being minorities, what do we do there? Frankly, we don't know all the answers there. Why they leave before lieutenant colonel, before colonel, why they don't want to stay in the running for command, we need to find those answers out.
This next question is actually from Task and Purpose's inimitable Jeff Shogel. The Marines have still not made boot camp gender integrated at the platoon level, although obviously the 2020 NDAA includes a provision mandating it within 5 years at Parris Island. I understand you've tried integrating a company or two, but that the male and female recruits are still living on separate floors. Can you tell us when the first gender integrated platoons will start recruit training?
Parris Island is the only place that female Marines train. We have two places where we train recruits on the East and West Coast. Parris Island historically is the only place we've ever trained them. Because we had such a small percentage, all the math just drove them decades ago to let's just do it in a single location. So we're not set up right coast to coast at all. And even at Parris Island, and many folks probably have been down there, you have male barracks, and then down the road is the female barracks. So nothing, the way we're organized right now, lends itself to an integrated recruit training. But if that's our start point, and it is, we have to get to a place where on both coasts or at a third location or whatever we end up with, that every recruit, male, female, there's male and female around. So we can't even fix it in the immediate term because we're not built. We're not in the facility wise. We have changes we got to make. Mm-hmm. We have integrated companies. Last year, 5 of them. This year, more of them. Why? Because it makes sense. Why would you have a separate female battalion? And if let's say you're a applicant, we're going to tell you to wait until April, please. Can you just wait until April? Because that's when the next female battalion starts. You're like, well, isn't there one in January and February? And our answer, prior to this has been that's true. There are male companies. Please wait till April. So just from a constant sort of a flow, this makes absolute sense to integrate at the company level. Those who also have been to recruit training at Parris Island or San Diego would see the same things that we see, that the platoon, there is a coherent, cohesive structure to a platoon. That's the strength. That's your peers. That's what, frankly, you know, at 9, 10 o'clock at night, those are the people who go like, I don't think I can make it. Those are the ones who tell you, yeah, you can make it. We're both quitting or we're both going. You got it? And you just do it. The platoon is really the strength. They are billeted as platoons. And the last part I'll just mention, we train very differently than other services. So it's very difficult to compare apples and apples. For us, for the other services, a training day ends at a certain time. And then you and I go back to our barracks. Then the next training day is the next day. Not in Marine world. I mean, in our world, officer or enlisted, the training is in the barracks also. It's 24 hours a day. So our drill instructors are in the barracks 24 hours a day, coaching us, mentoring us. So our training is very, very different. Most of the training that happens in the barracks, you know, that's the part that keeps you going, that motivates you. So we're comfortable where we are in terms of integration level, but we have a long way to go because we have a West Coast, half the Marine Corps never sees a female recruit at all. We got a lot of room to work.
If we stick with Parris Island, though, you know, what is the end state of integration look like to your mind? I mean, is it as simple as solving some of these infrastructure problems? You know, like, what does this look like when we get, you know, say 5 years down the line?
Yeah. It's not as, to your point, you're not inferring that it is, but it's definitely not as simple as build a couple buildings and we'll be there.
Right.
But we do have to, address that because otherwise we're not set up on the West Coast at all for zero females. So we could go all the way to Nirvana on the East Coast and still have half the Marine Corps training without any female recruits there. Okay, that's not Nirvana in any way, in anybody's construct. So the infrastructure, the facilities part is key, is a first step. That costs money, and we have to put that in motion now. Second part is the people, the trainers. All of our female drill instructors are on the East Coast. Well, we got to not only build buildings and fix that part, but we got to find a way with our drill instructors to balance it. And we're going to, I think, run a couple trials this winter time, actually moving drill instructors from South Carolina to San Diego, like TDY, TAD, and train recruits on the West Coast and see how this is going to work. But there's no provisions on the West Coast, there have never been, for females. So Nirvana, you know, what is the end state, the 5 years down the road look like? We will not have all the buildings built and all the pieces in place fast enough to satisfy anybody. But as many as possible, all companies, wherever they are, our training mixed platoons, then we're in good shape. We're well down the road then.
I'm going to turn to the question of promotion for Marines who identify as minorities. Thanks to Helene Cooper's excellent reporting, there's been a lot of public attention paid to the case of Colonel Anthony Henderson, a combat tested black colonel who's been passed over three times for promotion. I think the quote that she had in the story from a former Marine gunnery sergeant was, "Tony Henderson has done everything you could do in the Marines except get a hand salute from Jesus Christ himself." And so while I know that you probably can't discuss Colonel Henderson's case specifically, I'm hoping you can give us a sense of your thinking of why, out of 82 Marine generals overall today, there are only 6 African-American brigadier generals and one major general.
Most of us know, in the Marine Corps is pretty small, so we deal in individual people. We don't deal in numbers, first of all, because there are only 80 generals. We know each other. So it's not like it's an unknown. For a promotion board to brigadier general, we each year select 10 to 12 out of 550 to 600. That's how competitive it is. So the reality of it is everybody is really, really, really good. In the Marine Corps, we do not look at selection to Brigadier General as passed over in any way, because we're choosing 10 out of 600. That's not, the odds are way against each one of us. And for every 10, you know, every 10 we picked, every 12, we could pick 30 more, every bit as good. To answer your question about, so what do we do about improving the diversity at the most senior ranks? Well, first of all, I think it's tough. I know the article, and I know the intent behind it. But the consequence of it is, there's not, no matter what happens now, Tony's in a tough spot. Mm-hmm. If he doesn't get selected, it's X. If he does get selected this year, it's Y. Both of which are, none of which is fair to Colonel Henderson at all. In other words, even if he's selected, it's going to be tough. Mm-hmm. Oh, it was because of the article.
Right.
Okay, so, and I know him. I have worked with him. It's, I think, put him in a tough spot. I wish there were no names used. But we are, this is where we are. Mm-hmm. I think it's not, you can't fix it at a board. I know this. I've been on promotion boards for a decade. It's assignments. It's opportunities beforehand. It's mentoring. It's getting the pool of a deep pool, a deep bench of qualified candidates to that board. And then it's based on merit. It's the best 10 that that board could pick, 10 or 12 out of 600. But what we have to do is focus all the way from recruiting to the selection of their specialty, to what kind of planes they're going to fly, to captain, to major, to lieutenant colonel, mentoring. We got to bring that all the way through the pipeline, because in our world, we're a very war-fighting, combat arms-focused organization. To get that at point, we're looking at how well did that officer do in command? Back to your point earlier. So we have to focus on the very beginning recruiting, which we do very, very well, the specialties that they choose, the airplane selection that they get, all the way through. And that way we'll arrive at that board with a superbly qualified pool that's very diverse. And they are absolutely very superbly qualified. We just got to improve the diversity of the pool that gets to that place.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I'm gonna step away from the diversity question, and I'm gonna kind of move this into my next sort of bucket of questions here. The United States is having a public discussion about civ-mil relations in a way that I think has a lot of people using the word unprecedented, that extremely overused word in Washington. In the last 6 months, we've debated the use of the Insurrection Act. We've talked about camouflage worn by civilian law enforcement officials, whether a protest in Washington, D.C. qualify as a battle space. But I think maybe most extraordinarily, we've seen a number of retired general officers speak out publicly in opposition to the sitting president's handling of the protests in a way that they say breached that kind of sacred civ-mil divide. And several of those men have been Marines. And as the current commandant, I want to ask you, what do you expect from Marine general officers after they retire? And when, if ever, is it helpful or appropriate for them to speak out on the politics of the day?
I don't think I'm going to say anything that hasn't been said, because it's, to your point, been, this has been unpacked a couple times over the past few decades, but it's a conversation we have to have. First, I would say we, as general officers, when we retire, need to consider that our individual citizen rights and responsibilities and all that goes along with that are one aspect. But the way the rest of the larger population views us, we have to factor that in and the impact on the institution that we just left. In other words, the things that I say while retired are connected to the active duty Army and Navy and Air Force and Marine Corps, whether I like it or not. I can say personally, hey, I'm not in uniform anywhere anymore, so I'm free to speak my mind. True, you are a citizen with all of the rights that go along with that. But when your introduction is retired admiral, retired general, there's a direct connecting tissue back to those of us who are wearing uniform today, and we must remain apolitical. So we have to be conscious of the fact that no matter what, when we're retired. Our views, if the more public they are, they're always going to be linked, tied back to the service that's defending the nation today, this afternoon. And you can say that that's not, I didn't intend for that to happen. That's not my point. It doesn't matter. The connecting file is there. So I ask him to be really thoughtful about engaging either side. It doesn't matter. In partisan politics, all of us should say go vote. But when it comes to partisan politics, a lineup on stage of 20 or 40 or 60 retired admirals or generals reflects on the institution today. It reflects on the Joint Chiefs and the chairman today. They have to be aware of that.
All right, I'm going to let you talk about the fun stuff now. there's also been an enormous amount of discussion about your force redesign plans to get the Marines to move from a kind of land-centric force to a more littoral one, concentrated on competing with China. And there seems to be this broad agreement that the strategy is a good one, but that, again, the devil is in the details. So I want to talk a little bit about how you do this. And I think the first and sort of obvious question is, even before the pandemic, analysts were predicting stagnant Pentagon budgets and, according to some, steep cuts. And you've obviously been explicit about, you know, we're not going to be asking for more money. But the pandemic and a growing deficit has only underscored that sort of expectation that we're likely going to be looking at a shrinking budget. So what impact do you, sort of longer term impact, do you anticipate budget constraints as a result of the pandemic specifically are going to have on the implementation of your planning guidance?
That is a great question. $1 million question.
I know. Where's your crystal ball?
Yeah. It could. We should anticipate that it could delay. It could impact two ways. It could impact today's readiness of today's forces in other words, depending on how Congress and the executive branch work things out in the coming years, it could dive into this afternoon's readiness. But to your pointed question, it can also affect the rate at which we can transform, move the Marine Corps into where it's got to be a decade from now, which would be okay. That would be okay if we weren't pressed by an adversary or two that are moving pretty quickly. So our challenge is I think my role then is to convey to our senior civilian leaders, if you affect our budget in a way that retards, slows down the redesign of the Marine Corps, the posturing of what we need to be for 2030, if you slow that down, here's the risk. Assuming the adversary moves like this, if the Marine Corps moves and the Army and the Navy moves like this, here's the gap. And they make policy. My job is to convey that risk down the road in the future years, what it means. I don't think it means, in other words, on a simpler note, I don't think it means we won't do force design. Mm-hmm. It definitely could affect the rate, the speed. Right. And my worry is that, again, when you're not pressed by an adversary, then you can go at a different pace. But if they are moving very quickly, and anything that retards your modernization, your transformation, that's a big risk we're going to carry forward. I think is on our shoulders as Joint Chiefs to express that, to articulate that.
Another budget question that I have that's sort of more from an organizational standpoint is Navy Marine Corps integration is obviously another big hallmark of your guidance. And one hard step that some have called for, including Congressman Mike Gallagher, who actually is going to be speaking on our second panel later today. He has publicly advocated for pulling the Navy N8 and the Marine Corps programs and resources out from under their respective service chains of command and co-locating them on equal footing under the Secretary of the Navy. Is that under consideration? Would you support that?
I would say on a couple levels. First, just the staff-to-staff integration. We're on the same hallway here in the Pentagon, like most people know. They're down the hall from us. So from one aspect, it's not hard for the secretary to get us in the same room. It's not like we're on opposite sides of the world. Over the years, I would say two different levels. First is personal relationships matter, but they aren't, they can never be the, they can't, that can't make the difference. In other words, you can't rely on that. I think the relationship right now in N9, our combat development and integration down in Quantico, the N8 on the Navy side, our programs and resources, that foursome of three-star admirals and generals working very well right now. Part of that is personality based on the relationship the CNO and I have, but part of it, frankly, is not a backs against the wall, but a clear sense that, well, if we work the way we sometimes have in our own lanes and fight against each other here, to your point earlier, in a flat budget forecast, that's not going to go well. And then the second one is just a warfighting one, a pure warfighting look. Neither one of us, none of the services alone can deter by themselves. And the most powerful tool that the U.S. military has, I'm biased, is a Navy Marine Corps team that knows how to work together. Nobody else on the planet comes close to that when we're hitting on all cylinders. So there's driving forces here that drive us together. Do they have to be in the same chain of command working for the same Secretary of the Navy? They don't have to. There's nothing secretive that's happening right now that I can't see into the Navy's portfolio. They can't see into ours. Mm-hmm. And the Secretary is halfway in between us. Figuratively and literally, he's halfway in between our offices.
Right.
I'm very comfortable, confident right now that everything is on the table. Will that carry forward next 2 years, five, seven? I don't know. Mm-hmm. And I've heard the proposition: you should transfer your money, people, and have them work down the hall for the secretary. But I have Title 10 responsibilities, as does Admiral Gilday, that I must do by law. That involves our resources, our money. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, I mean, critics, it strikes me that this is sort of related, that critics of your planning guidance, like, you know, former Navy Secretary Jim Webb, have argued that, you know, that overall your planning guidance is going to make the Marine Corps subordinate to the funding and operational requirements of the Navy at the expense of the Corps. But, I mean, it's, you know, it sounds like this is an area in which you are, you know, right now at any rate, sort of safeguarding that independence and is sort of, it would be an answer to that criticism. Is that fair?
Fair. I think, I don't think there's a Marine senior leader who hasn't, like, a little bit of, not paranoia, but we know our history, like, they'll come after us if we fall asleep at night. So somebody, one of you four, stay awake, because they're going to come after us. It's in our, like, DNA. But that's a good thing. I don't sense any part of that right now. That was clearly the case in the 1950s. It's not right now. The Marine Corps is 186,000 strong, and nobody does what we do. And no one in this building is, I think, you know, the best thing we can do tomorrow is do away with the Marine Corps. No one is anywhere. That conversation, it would be difficult to imagine it, although it has happened in our past. I don't subscribe to the theory that we're headed down a path where we're going to be a junior partner or subordinate to the Navy. Don't subscribe to that. I don't see that at all down the road.
One of the sort of specific places that it seems like the kind of the rubber is meeting the road here is with the development of a new light amphibious warship. But I mean, obviously there's a trade-off between the cost and capability and your ability to field these things more quickly and, you know, what the Navy might want and what the Marine Corps specifically wants. And so I'm hoping you can tell us a little bit about just where that project stands right now and what decisions need to be made about what you want.
We have, As most folks know, you included note, we have three different sizes, flavors of amphib ships right now, and they do great for us. They have done great for us in the way that we've needed to operate so far. But that's not the only way we're going to need to operate going forward. My proposition is those three families of pretty expensive high-end ships are not enough. We need a more diverse family of ships in order to compete every day, in order to be ready for a crisis or a conflict, hence the light amphibious warship, which we don't know what it will look like. We know we need something that's smaller, that doesn't have as much draft, that can move us around from ship to shore or shore to shore over great distances, but it's but it's affordable. Whatever that turns out to be will broaden the portfolio, give us more tools. I need to give commanders the means, to the mobility to move in a distributed operating environment. The light amphibious warship, whatever that turns out to be, is part of that. So far, within the Navy, within the Department of Defense, every single war game for the past 5 months has borne that out. In other words, the converse, if you don't have that, they're going to know how you're moving around and easier to target. We got to make it hard.
The other thing that your guidance has been sort of widely praised for is for, you know, goring some sacred cows, for divesting legacy equipment that doesn't make sense for the Marine Corps of 2025 or 2030, and you know, hopefully replacing them with this, some of these new capabilities. But, you know, both Congress and industry obviously have some say here. So talk to me a little bit about what your strategy has been for getting stakeholders on board with your divestment plan specifically, and what have the roadblocks been?
We're way beyond hope first. and you weren't intending to mean it in that manner, but through some great coaching from mentors of mine, I'm going to use an example. They said, when you get to a certain part down the road, halfway, two-thirds down the road, what you really need to do is make appointments with individual ranking and minority members, the chairs of the eight committees. Tell them what you're doing. Tell them why. Tell them you're going to need their help, and answer all their questions and make them partners in this. I took that advice. And that takes extra time to sit down with eight individual members, senators and congressmen and their staffs, and explain, lay all in front of them. This is the Marine Corps force design. This is where we are today. This is where we think we're going to end up a decade from now, and the logic behind it. So it takes a lot of extra time. Absolutely great advice to me. Because I listened to their feedback. It has made some changes to the direction we're going. But from that moment on, they're part of it. They're not waiting for a finished product here. Can you please fund this? We have a plan. No, it's more like we're headed down this path. We need your help along the way. You've seen lots of movies before. Lots of transformations before, so help us make sure we're good at making good decisions. I've got nothing but good advice and strong support, both sides of the aisle. In other words, none of this is partisan. All of them, first of all, thanks for including us early in the conversation rather than the finished kind of tied it in a bow. We need you to fund this. But that's actually the genuine listening part, really helpful to us. Where's the friction been? The friction has been where we've been not as good in communicating. From Jim Webb to Congress to industry, the failure has been on our part. We'll always assume that the failure on our part in the Marine Corps is a failure to communicate from our end. Because that means we have to do better at communicating. That means their judgments are either based on old information, or we just haven't communicated to them yet. We need to do always a better job of that. The last part I'd say is, and I wouldn't call it friction in a negative sense, is industry saying, where are you going with this? You know, give us an indicator of where you're going with F-35s. Tell us where you're going with 53Ks. Tell us where you're going with amphib ships. Because rightfully so, from constituents to industry, they need some forecast, some predictability. So I think it's not friction, but it's rightful concern. Okay, tell us where this might go so we can make adjustments and support you.
I want to turn to how you envision the Corps being used in the conflicts of the future, sort of understanding that your planning guidance was built in part on extensive wargaming. And I'm going to turn to an audience question for the course first question here. This is from John Doyle. A possible conflict in the Indo-Pacific region has been characterized as facing a framework similar to World War II, vast distances, logistical comms, long-range fires, aviation challenges, including likely high attrition. Is the Marine Corps resigned to high casualties in such a conflict? And follow-up, how can attrition be mitigated with technology or strategy?
No, we're not resigned to high casualties, but we should not think that in a great power competition, it's going to be clean.
Yeah.
We need to, we're not in any way preparing for an attrition fight. Neither is the adversary. Neither one of us wants that. I think that our challenge is going to be that different than other scenarios where both potential adversary is pretty strong, you're not going to look for a symmetric, you know, head on head kind of competition at all. So we're going to try to find weaknesses in how they're organized, trained, and equipped. They're going to try to find our weaknesses and go after them. So both of us are not looking for a strength on strength fight at all. We're not looking for a fight, period. All that to say, this has not come without risk. Great power competition, as does counterinsurgency, comes with casualties if it comes to a scrap. So what do we have to do about that? Okay, we have to distribute the force, first of all, to give the adversary a lot of looks from a lot of different directions in every single domain. So in other words, we're not spreading out because we're scared of being clumped together and might get killed all in a pile. That's not the point. The point is, if you're a maneuverist, which I am, then you distribute so that you can present a lot of different looks to the adversary. You can collect from a lot of different angles. You make it very difficult for them to focus their strengths.
Right.
So holding down casualties is not, we got to spread out or else we all might, you know, we're all very vulnerable clumped in together. That's true at the tactical level, but at the operational level, it's distribution. It's a distributed way of fighting, maneuvering, so that you can put the enemy in a dilemma and he said, okay, it's not worth it today.
I mean, I would, you know, I mean, perhaps to sort of restate the question, you know, that because I was sort of thinking about how to ask something like this of you myself. Yeah. You know, we are talking about fighting a peer competitor here, though. You're not talking about sort of the situation that the United States has been in, you know, really since the Gulf War, where we were technologically vastly outpowering the, you know, the enemy that you were fighting. So, you know, maybe the question is the assumption as part of, you know, is what your wargaming telling you that, you know, higher casualty rates is something that the American public would have to sort of come to grips with in this kind of conflict?
It's a policy kind of a question, I suppose. I mean, at the military level, we have to have the mechanics in place. And we do. But we haven't had that kind of high number of casualties in a long while. So there is clearly, the public is not sensitized to that today on either side.
Right.
Hence, in other words, back to my point, neither side wants that kind of a conventional force-on-force fight. Neither side is really, that doesn't work to either advantage. We have to work on our mechanics and also sensitize ourselves. We're used to a golden hour in Afghanistan or Iraq. Like within 1 hour, you get knocked down, you're shot in the leg, boom. You know, you're in a level 3 within 60 minutes. That's the yardstick. That's not reasonable when you're fighting a distributed fight. So that means we have to have the medical capability more forward than we did before. More distributed has to be the medical capability. We need different medical capability. Because you may not get to a level 3 for 4 hours or 4 days. So the medical care that we have to provide on site to you got to be a lot different than golden hour means just patch them together, stabilize them, get them on a plane. We have to deliver medical capabilities, logistics, far forward in a different way than we needed to in Afghanistan or Iraq.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. I mean, talk to me a little bit about what do you see as the biggest logistical challenges in the event that you're actually sending Marines into this space to fight?
There are a number of different functions of warfare, like you most folks on the net are going to know. The ones that are fun to talk about are the lethal stuff or command and control. It like gets everybody's attention. It kills things or it electronically it connects us all together in this fuse command. Those are fun things to talk about. Logistics, hard to keep people's attention. However, this is where people long before you and me have written the right things down that, you know, experts, professionals talk logistics. Why? Why is that important now? You're hinting at it. We have not needed to worry about what was behind us before. No one challenged that. No one really threatened that other than, okay, a couple people with an IED might blow up a vehicle. That's going to delay our resupply. That was the extent of our logistical backside watching. It was never really threatened. We have to assume that a peer adversary is going to go after any soft spot that they might perceive. We should assume they're going to go after our command and control. We should assume they're going to go after our logistics. Absolutely, yes. It's contested. We're going to go after their logistics if it gets to that point. So we have to approach our backside, which really we took for granted before. We have to approach it in a different way. That 360 degrees, they will try to put pressure on us in any weak spot that they sense. We're going to do the same.
Are we right to think about places like Palau as a staging base to support forward forces as part of this EBO concept? And I'm going to stop for those in the audience who are as bad at acronyms as I am. That's Expeditionary Advanced Base Operations.
We are right in from two angles. One, the allies and partners sort of framework. I don't think most people really understand what the value of that is at the strategic and at the operational level, all the way down to the tactical level. But we just talk allies and partners because it's easy to say. It is such a strength of the U.S. to draw from so many different angles. So working with nation states, big and small, in Europe, in the Indo-PACOM, in Palau, absolutely yes. Second is the posturing, the positioning aspect, the positional aspect of it. Yeah, absolutely, yes. Do you want different places to be able to use for basing, to have for access, to use for overflight? You bet you do. Because all that allows our tactical commanders more freedom to come up with plans instead of, you only can use these two spots. So my job, our job at the top, give them as many options as possible. And the allies and partners part is huge.
I'm going to go to another audience question. This is from Brian McGrath, a fellow Wahoo, go Hoos. General, your decision to move from an organic UAV and the MUX program to a land-based solution seems short-sighted and far less integrated than other aspects of your vision. Why move from working on a UAV solution that meets both MUX requirements and surface Navy requirements?
I saw an article on this a few days ago, and Brian's question is a fair one, I think. And this is, I suppose, my answer to that would be, we have not communicated clearly. Again, failure on our part to communicate. We're not giving up on a shipboard UAV by any stretch of the imagination. But we had to make a decision. Do we move? Do we continue moving quickly now with what's near term that will help us learn and move towards technologically what is needed, which is a shipboard, a MUX in our acronymology, and a MUX with a medium altitude and long endurance sort of capability. We need that. Yes, we absolutely do. Today, is it available in an affordable manner? No, it's not. So we can either wait 4 or 5 years, or we can learn fast. We're learning fast. We're going to field, in other words, unmanned aerial system squadrons fast. We will move to a hybrid of Group 2 up to Group 5, land and ship, over the next decade. But what we were not willing to do is say, we can't afford it, or it's not technologically feasible today, so let's just wait 2 or 3 years. We're not going to wait. We have to move now. But that's not the end game by any stretch.
From Christopher Woody, have you gotten feedback about your force redesign from partner forces in the Indo-Pacific? Is there a different posture of presence they want the Marine Corps to have in their countries? And I would sort of add to that, if you can answer that sort of specifically. I know it's hard to sort of talk about one partner or one ally or one country or another, but you know, insofar as you're able to kind of do that specifically, that would be great.
I can, and I don't think they would. It's not talking out of school at all. I'll give you a couple examples. The answer is yes, on not just Indo-PACOM, but also in UCOM as well. I'll just use those two as examples. Over the past several months, probably talk with General Burr in Australia 3 or 4 times at least. My counterpart, the Royal Marine Commandant in the UK, several times. I talked to the first Sea Lord yesterday. The Rock Marines, we have a 50, 60 year history of working with them. They translated our planning guidance and our force design into Hangul. If that illustrates for you, are they interested? They translate it into their language so that they can understand where we're going and partner with us. Same with the Japanese Self-Defense Force. So the answer is yes. In phone calls, in exchanging documents back and forth between us, in a manner, it may have happened before, but maybe I was at a more junior level and just didn't see it. But now we're sending them stuff. This is what we're working on. A month ago, I got something from Matt Holmes. It was probably 4 or 5 pages long from the UK. Hey, here's what we're doing in the latest kind of technology that they're using in the Royal Marine Commandos to remake themselves. Is any of this useful to you? So it's generated a very consistent dialogue now, peer-to-peer. In a good way.
This next question is from Gina Harkins at military.com. You were the first to come out and ban the Confederate flag on Marine Corps bases worldwide. As experts warn about the rising risk of far-right extremism, what are you doing to ensure these people aren't joining the ranks? Or if they're already in uniform, what are you doing to find them and get rid of them?
First step is to be very clear. And Gina, I don't think Gina would say it any different. You have to be very clear as a Department of Defense, as a Department of the Navy, as a Marine Corps about what is acceptable behavior and what is not. And you can't assume that everybody knows where that line is. So you have to be very, very clear. On the before they come into the service part, you know, what can we do better there? I think all the way down through social media, and really it boils down to a recruiter to high school student, officer, selection officer to college student. How well do they know that person? Now, there's still a lot that you can hide, clearly. If you have that leaning, you can deceive a recruiter and just never talk about it. He can ask you 100 times and just never show it. But on social media, I'm doing X. Okay, so we got to keep our radar up before they come in. Once they come in, A, you have to introduce the set of values that the Marine Corps has in a way that absorbs everything. The honor, courage, commitment has to be the centerpiece for them. And then they have to see clearly that doesn't match up with how I grew up in high school or middle school or whatever. So there is a transformation that happens with Marines that's very, very important. That's not the end, of course, and that's why the question. Even afterwards, some of them still harbor a sense that whatever they harbor. So you have to be ruthless in rooting it out. And when you find it, you got to separate it like a cancer quickly, because it clearly will spread. And it'll spread in an underground black kind of, the dark web sort of way, in a mode where it's not apparent. Really hard to root out. But that nothing crushes cohesion faster than that kind of a one-off in a unit. It just starts to tear apart the fabric at the tactical level. We can't have that.
I'm going to go back to the force redesign. You know, we've talked a lot about the orientation of this new force redesign towards China, but what would be different about applying it in the Black Sea, for example, or in the Gulf?
Here I'll start with the first and foremost, the Marine Corps. If you had to say, like, what is at the very center? What is at the very middle? You know, if you'd stripped everything else away, what is at the very middle? It is our core values, and it is our assigned responsibility by law to be a force in readiness anywhere, anytime when the nation is least ready. So we have to be prepared for anything, anywhere, when the country isn't really quite ready. Give us a little bit of time. We'll come with the cavalry. But right now, you have the Marines. And the Congress decided that in 1952. They confirmed it later on, that we can't have an entire million-man military that's all ready all the time. We can't afford that. But we can afford the Marine Corps. So what's different about Indo-PACOM and UCOM or CENTCOM or anywhere else? The approach we're taking is the concepts of warfighting. Expeditionary Advanced Base Operations, Littoral Operations in a Contested Environment. Those concepts for how we're going to operate in the future must be applicable in any region of the world. So they are not an Indo-PACOM concept. How would you modify it? How would you morph it? Well, like we always do, we take a structure. This is how we're organized, trained, and equipped. You lay it over top of the BAM in the Middle East and say, how would you do this? How would you hold the straits open? So all of our war games, all of our approaches so far go in with the assumption that we're not going to have an organization that is uniquely suited against a single adversary in a single scenario. We can't do that. It has to be applicable, although it may not optimize, have to be applicable everywhere. So it may be a different laydown in Europe. It's going to be a very different laydown in the CENTCOM AO because the ranges, the distances are very different. But our force that we're driving towards with things like littoral regiments, you could use that. You could operate with that in Europe. You could operate with that in UCOM.
I've got a question from Captain Walker Mills, who's watching from Colombia. With the Marine Corps focusing increasingly on the Pacific, should we expect less engagements in other regions like Southcom, and in your words, accept more risk in those areas? I should add Columbia, the country, not Columbia, South Carolina.
Back to Captain Mills. As a nation, and as a Marine Corps and Navy, we have to wait where we think the biggest risks are to the nation. That's why Indo-PACOM, by the direction of the Secretary of Defense, is a primary theater, because that's an existential threat in the long term. So we go where the nation needs us to go. To your point, is that going to mean less forces elsewhere? Yes, it will. Does it mean we don't go to Southcom? No, it doesn't. Will we be in AFRICOM theater? We will. And the concepts that the Department of Defense is using to address that are things like dynamic force employment that allow us to move forces around in different times in an unpredictable manner so that we can show up, not on a regular drumbeat schedule, but we can show up and make sure that we are working with our partners and allies and we are deterring. To answer your question, no, we're not walking away from South America or Africa or anywhere else. We will, as a nation, though, weight our military, as we should, towards what the nation sees as its greatest threats. That we will do. Yes.
I've got just about a minute left with you, General, and I've just been passed a very important piece of breaking news from Jeff Shogel that I think absolutely must be used for our last question, which is that three Marines and a sailor at Camp Lejeune have been bitten by a coyote, apparently running at night. Are you concerned about the threat of coyotes to your force?
I saw the article this morning. It's a rabid coyote. You can even watch the video. No, I am not concerned about rabid coyotes, endangering the threat of the Marine Corps. No, but it was a pretty good story. Pretty good.
General Berger, thank you so much for joining us, for taking so much time. This was with us. This was a thoughtful discussion, and we certainly appreciate it.
Well, from my end, I don't have a big closing speech because you don't need that. But I thank the questions that you had and the questions that the audience had. We write down, because just the nature of the questions, not the answers, the nature of the questions really, really helpful to us. So you're contributing to our force design and you didn't intend to. I'm just giving you credit for it. It helps shape in a way and that a lens that we may not be using. So very helpful. I'm appreciative. Thanks.
That's great. Well, thank you again so much for your time.
General David Berger there. How about that? Pretty interesting. To me, the thing that's most concerning, I go back to the start, is what's the first thing we're talking about? Force readiness? No. It's it's the same thing that the Secretary of the Navy wrote about. which are your Bill of Rights, your what's in it for you. It's not force readiness. It's not our ability to fight tonight. It's none of that. And so so it's pretty interesting to listen to this stuff. And I thought it was an interesting conversation to hear him talk about the engagement of the Marine Corps around the world. The bottom line is this, though, and this is what General Berger's on the hook for. General Berger has taken legacy systems in the Marine Corps, tanks, tubed artillery, and he's got rid of them. And he didn't just get rid of them, and this is, to me, what the most valid criticism centers on. He gets rid of them throughout the Marine Corps. He didn't say 3MAF, you were going to be focused on the South China Sea and the Indian Ocean. 1MAF, you now have Korea. 3MAF will be in support of you in Korea, but Korea is a different fight. And we're going to take all the tanks in the Marine Corps and we're going to put them in 1MAF. It's going to be 2 tank battalions, and then we're going to have a 3rd tank battalion in the reserve. So 2 tank battalions as part of 1MAF, that's the heavy right hand. And then 2MAF will be able to swing to either theater as well as do Europe, right? And those tank battalions, right, can easily be, right, in support of 2nd Marine Division, blah, 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 blah. And so again, to me, this Marine Corps that's all the same, to me, something doesn't make sense about it. Either something we don't know doesn't make sense that, you know. But sometimes a tank's a pretty handy thing to have. Most military organizations have them for good reasons. Now, I know they're expensive, so is there a way to mitigate it? Is there a way to... I don't know. Excuse me. So... I thought, General Berger, interesting guy. And I thought the questions were pretty good. But again, the dominant theme, it seems like in these, the social messaging part of the DOD seems to be always first. So, Defense One's national security correspondent, Katie Bo Williams, I thought she did a good job too. So, well done. Anyway, if you're just tuning in, stay tuned for the news hour. It's pretty substantial and robust today. I talk about a couple other things. I talk about the hypocrisy of Joe Biden being Catholic, and he's not being called out for it. But a future potential Supreme Court justice, she'll be excoriated for it. Talk about whether I'll watch the baseball is on, or will I watch the debates. I'll probably opt for baseball. I'm not going to lie to you. And then I saw an interesting comment made by Ari Fleischer. Talked about the Supreme Court confirmation process. Washington, D.C. going to get burned down as that happens? And what will be the political implications for a party that's trying to convince undecided Americans that they're the party to lead us when they won't stand up and condemn shit like that? So talk about that. And then just the scourge of the earth that is social media and what it does. How social media has impacted news reporting. Nothing but horrible. So anyway, Don't touch that dial. This program continues momentarily. Have a great day. On a Tuesday, Almarin Radio. Out. And, oh, by the way, don't be afraid to change somebody's life.